Unfiltered opinions.
Sometimes you have ideas and you're not quite sure why.
You secure the bag.
Sometimes you meet people and realize there's probably a reason why you stayed in touch.
Just listen.
Sometimes all the pieces just come together by themselves.
Woo! I'm Jimmy Moyaha.
I'm Nicolette Mashile.
And I'm Simon Brown.
Welcome to Insider Exchange.
So the Gaga album, finally listened to the whole thing?
Yeah, repeatedly.
And?
It's boring. It's a movie theme song type. Yeah, movie theme song, right? There's going to be maybe one, maybe two. You know, you're too young to remember the first Top Gun Berlin. It was a great song, great artist, but no one ever heard of them again. The rest of the album was boring. She's got a proper album coming next year.
So this is not a real album?
No. Doesn't count.
Okay. I suppose that's how soundtracks are, right? Most of the soundtracks, you have a soundtrack for a particular movie, a particular theme, or a particular time. It's like the Rihanna soundtrack that people weren't so keen on because everybody'd been waiting for years. And then people are like, Rihanna, drop an album. Then she drops the soundtrack to Black Panther 2. And then people were like, this is not what we asked for. No. We requested an album.
Yeah. Learned my lesson. Okay. Are we going to do music reviews when we start every week?
Why not?
That's cool.
That could be fun. Well, I mean, we'll have to get a turntable in here and see if we can get some real music in here.
I got a turntable.
You see, there we go. Let's kick things off. Let's get the show on the road. In Market Matters this week, we take a look at inflation data that's come out this week from the European zone, from South Africa, from China, and from even the UK. We also look at earnings season that's kicked off in the US with the banks giving us some really strong numbers, and we reflect on the legacy of the late Tito Mboweni, former Reserve Bank governor and former Minister of Finance in South Africa. Let's start with the unfortunate news, the untimely news that we got sort of last week around the passing of our former finance minister. And he was a very interesting finance minister in the time in which he was finance minister. I mean, there's a lot that's been said around the fact that South Africa's shift in monetary policy was under his leadership and under his guidance. And then there was also the conversations around the fact that Rand manipulation took place while he was the same position. So, I mean, but overall, there cannot be a shadow of a doubt around the impact and the positive impact that the former minister, former governor contributed towards what we currently have.
100%. I mean, fun fact, he was 35 years old when nominated to Mandela's cabinet. What are you doing at 35?
Because
I'm going to be quite honest, I was not cabinet material. I mean, I'm still not, but anyway. And we go all the way back and he went to Lesotho and he's like, give me a gun, I want to join the armed struggle. And they were like, no, we're going to send you to England and to university. Mm. And I think he's one of our top, can't think of the word, important people in our body politic. And we've got to go back to him as a Labour minister in the Mandela government, where he brought in all sorts of, I mean, you know, just codified rules, the public occupation, all of those sort of, you know, I mean, we all think, oh, Labour laws, hate the Labour laws. That's because you're capital. If you're Labour, you like the laws. It's a simple distinction. But he brought in simple things like maternity, like lunch hours. He brought in mine safety, those posters we see everywhere, the CCMA. Mm-hmm. I mean, he really fundamentally changed our labor landscape as best as you can with laws, right? We still have chronic unemployment. Folks will tell you that's part of the problem. I disagree. If your business doesn't work, if you've got to pay below minimum wage to make your business work, you don't have a business. It's just that simple. Your business model is broken. So he did the labor laws. Then he went off and became the first black governor of our Reserve Bank. And I remember the market freaking out. We had Chris Stolz. Now let's remember, Chris Stolz spent $20 plus billion in 1998 trying to defend our currency and lost. So Tito Mboweni comes into what is a mess of central bank. And he makes it not a mess. He formalizes these MPC meetings that we have where in the olden days you would wake up in the morning and rates changed. Like, what happened? Rates are up or down, you know. And he formalized that whole process. They brought in inflation targeting. We were one of the first countries in the world to bring in inflation targeting. And he did a really, really good job in sort of professionalizing the SARB. And then he went off to Machaberskloof, which is an awesome part of the world, to spend time with his garlic and avos. And then got called back under Ramaphosa to do the stint. And there's one of his tweets, because his Twitter feed is just So much fun. There's a tweet of his last, I think it was maybe his last cabinet meeting. And it's a picture of him walking up to the union buildings and he's like, hate this job. He didn't want to do it. He didn't want to do it. Mm. He really had to be dragged out of his, he was having fun. He was, you know, on the board of Anglo Gold Ashanti and a JP Morgan or something. Somebody, I forget, maybe it was Chase Consultant. And he was, you know, and living in Machaberskloof.
And he should have realistically been the brand ambassador for Lucky Star by the end of this. I mean,
if Lucky Star don't do something and do a commemorative series of fish or something, they are missing a trick. He was just, and you know what he was? Open-minded is such a cliched phrase, but he was that. I mean, you know, his tweets with Julius Malema. One of my faves is the ANC was having a golf day out in Zinine, and Fikile Mbulu arrives, Jason Pollock looking pants, and then a shirt that's even louder. And Tito Mboweni takes a photo, puts it on Twitter, and says, "Yo, Cadre, I'm not sure about that, especially not in Zinine." He was fun, and serious. And immensely good at what he did, like immensely good. We as a country owe him such a debt of gratitude. And 65, just young.
I think that's what you don't realize around a portfolio like the finance ministry is for you to be called out of retirement for your national duty, and that's your national duty. You have to have been exceptionally good at something, and I think the fact that he was, again, people were always saying he was able to reinvent himself over the years. Very few people know he was even Labour Minister.
I know.
You know? I mean, you remember the
youths,
him.
The youths know him as someone who cooks on Twitter.
You see? So, and you forget that at some point he signed off on the money. But that is the legacy. And that is a legacy that was kind of short, I suppose, because, again, gone too soon. But we reflect on that. And we're grateful to have had him as the minister that he was, and in the portfolio that he was, and the contributions that he made to the country, and to the fact that we can now have these conversations.
Yeah.
We can now have the inflation conversation that we're having now around the South African picture and inflation moderating, and you look at the current Reserve Bank governor and how stern and steadfast he is. That kind of portfolio and leadership, I mean, as you said, Tito Mboweni being the first, had to have set that bar in place to say, this is what needs to happen. Yeah. And when we get into our deep dive as well around sovereign wealth funds, he was vocal about that as well. But let's wrap up market matters and before we get into the rest of the show, because I want to look at those inflation numbers. We got the Chinese inflation data. We got the US inflation data beforehand, missed very slightly. We also got European, UK, and South African inflation data. By all accounts, it looks as though the inflation bug is kind of subdued, under control. Yeah, there's a couple of hits and misses here and there, not coming in exactly on time, in line with forecasts and expectations. But seldom does data really do that, you know, and it's not like the misses are significant enough to worry us.
No, 100%. I do. I mean, you know, even US inflation was lower, but not as low as expected. But, you know, 2.4, it's getting to that point. Inflation is going the right way. And it was always the case of, you know, Wayne McCurry would tell you, what's the best thing for inflation? High prices, because you set a base and the next year you've got the base. And because people must remember, inflation's coming down doesn't mean prices are coming down. It means prices are going up slower, which is critically important. The new levels are locked in. So 2.4 in the US, I mean, that's a you know, the target's 2. That's almost in the zone of being at the target. And the trend is definitely down. I mean, we've got our own coming up. Expectations are that the October inflation, we won't get that until late November, mid-November, is going to be like sub 4, maybe even 3.5%. I tell you one thing so one good thing is that shelter is starting to come. Now, shelter's sticky because you don't move often, right? So there's not a lot of resetting happening, and they use weird surveys in the US, et cetera. What's worrying me is food. We're seeing there is a global UN food thing. I'll find the official name for it because it is more than a mouthful. Okay. And it talks around the inflation bits. And we're seeing some pressure coming through on inflation in the global space. And most notably, perhaps, it is the UN Food and Agriculture Organization's Global Food Price Index.
Okay, wow. That is a mouthful.
That's a mouthful, and it's rising. So mostly sugar And sugar is droughts in Brazil, and then India lifting bans or lifting restrictions on ethanol production. So we'll see sugar go into ethanol production if it offers better value. And that kind of pushed sugar prices up. But it's worth keeping a close eye on food inflation, which had finally sort of collapsed. Mm. But all in all, inflation is doing what you want, right? We had that high base. The US got to 9.1, the highest in 40 plus years. I think the UK got to 11.
Crazy.
The
stuff.
Highest in 40 plus years.
South Africa got to 11, the normal levels in 40 number. Years.
Yeah, yeah. We actually didn't, I'm not even sure if we got double digit, but anyway.
No, I don't think we got double digit, but we got to very normal inflationary levels for South Africa.
For South Africa.
So no one's really surprised there.
And what we are seeing is the short answer is inflation is coming down, and this is lacquer. This is important, and it absolutely matters, because we need the continuation of rate cuts. Now, whether we continue to get them coming down aggressively, I mean, there's T's and C's there, but certainly we need that sense. What did we peak at? We peaked at 7.8.
Oh, there we go. We were close to double digits.
That was July 22.
We were so cute. We were so close. Look at that.
But weirdly, there was a moment there where the US had higher inflation than we did.
Yes.
Developed markets had higher inflation than we did. Problem with high inflation, so much of it is structural. It's ESCOM.
Look at how the country's been with 200 days of load shedding free South Africa. We still feel weird talking about those things. Companies that haven't cared about inflation. Banks. The ones that kick us off for US earnings season. It's always the banks. We usually start to, that gives us a bearing of how we can expect earnings season to shape up. And the other focal point outside of the banks is obviously the tech stocks with the Magnificent Seven and everything. US earnings season is in full swing for the final time in 2024. The banks gave us really strong numbers.
Yeah, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, BlackRock, which we spoke about recently. Wells Fargo is weird. So they did some fake account scandal a couple of years ago, if you remember. Mm-hmm. And their punishment, one of their punishments was their asset base can't be more than a certain amount. I think it's $1.7 trillion. So the fact that they're able to grow without, they've got a cap.
You've got a ceiling. That's horrendous.
It's completely weird. Your net interest revenue, of course, is income is coming down, but your non-interest income is doing great. The numbers were good. And you know, to your point, so we used to, Nick Kunzer from Sunlam reminded me, we used to kick off with Alcoa as the first reporting stock. I know, an aluminium smelter. Anyway, no longer the case. We now get banks coming in. And as go the first numbers, to a degree goes reporting season, and the market liked them. They were all up around 4.5%, 6% on Friday. The market is liking the numbers. Dami Dimon was cautious but optimistic. There's risks out there. There's always risks. No risk, no reward, no return. Market liked.
We spoke about BlackRock. Like you said, we added it to the wall a little while ago, and at the time, $9 trillion in assets under management is what we had as a figure. That figure has been updated to $11 trillion.
Yeah, they just added $2 trillion. And that basically,
US stimulus and the whole of sub-Saharan Africa's GDP's there.
Boom. Thank you very much.
Assets under management.
Which is just, so that's helped by, you know, a market up 20-odd%, but that doesn't account for all of it, you know. Mm-mm. So that would account for some of it, but they are growing, and they get that. The efficiencies in terms of they can, you know, crunch down on fees. People like bull markets. We're putting more money in, all of that sort of thing. And, you know, imagine, I mean, 11 trillion. I mean, and every month you charge a little fee.
Do you remember the Google conversation?
Mm.
Significant player, significant enough to warrant market abuse, largest player in the space.
But it comes back to, and we said it then, it's not illegal to be a monopoly.
Yeah.
It's illegal to abuse it. And that's the gray area.
Yeah, but if I own every single company that's worth owning in the US, surely I have the power to then start to borderline these abusive. I mean, think about Jamie Dimon, CEO at JP Morgan.
Yeah.
Right? JP Morgan, still, significant portion of that is owned by Larry Fink.
Yeah.
And BlackRock.
Yeah. So do you then just go and break up companies because of size? Because, I mean, you know, I mean, there's benefits of size, right? Scale. Yeah. So we get cheaper tours and all of that.
But you can also be a bully because
you
of size.
Absolutely. And in fact, if you've got the size and you're not using it as a bully, what are you doing? Like, to what?
Well, I think that perhaps that's part of BlackRock's thing at the moment, just to say, no, guys, we're not the bully. We're just a really good asset manager that just so happens to be the largest in the world. And we do have enough power and influence to move the entire S&P 500 with our positioning and all of that. But we won't, because we're responsible asset people managers.
They could also fundamentally change the face of American retirement by dropping all TERS by 2 points. Or rising it by 2 points. I mean, they do wield a bit of power, yes.
They do.
11 trillion.
So this is the thing. The amount of power and influence, is it enough to be considered significant, or is it borderline dangerous?
So they've got a lot of passive stuff as well, and they have a lot of active at the same time. It's a fair point. I mean, should there be an investigation into BlackRock? I don't know what the grounds would be. To the question of, is it potentially dangerous? Yes. But surely that would require BlackRock to do something which is not even in their own interests. Mm. In other words, you know, they would have to do something horrid and nasty, which could, I mean, they could crash financial markets. Pick a financial market. They could crash it. That's not in their interest either, surely. So are we just hoping on their good old-fashioned greed?
Well, this is the thing. You don't really know what's in their interest and what isn't. Because, I mean, if you think about their interests being the fall of other economies and protection of the US, then you've got a completely different conversation on your hands. But that's a conversation for another day.
Okay.
And we will we'll look at the size of BlackRock in comparison to our next conversation around a sovereign wealth funds. But that's Market Matters for this week. We move on to our deep dive. We're taking a look at sovereign wealth funds. There's been a lot of talk around that. We've touched on it in part, and we're going to be taking a look at the benefits and the merits of sovereign wealth funds and whether or not they make sense. We did government bailouts. We looked at stimulus, and you can't really have a look at that without looking at kind of countries that have gotten it right. And I say countries that have gotten it right because even at just under $1 trillion, the Saudi Public Investment Fund, which is their equivalent of a sovereign wealth fund, is not the largest sovereign wealth fund in the world.
Which is the largest? Is it Norway?
Yes!
It's Norway.
It's Norway!
Invests in 9,000 companies across 70 countries, holding 1.5% of all listed global companies.
But there is a pattern, right? And I wanna pick up on the pattern. The guys that make up sort of the top five, top six-ish of sovereign wealth funds by size in the world, your list comprises of Kuwait, comprises of Saudi Arabia, comprises of the UAE, China, Norway. Now, Norway's is from the sale of oil. And by extension, you can assume safely that the Middle Eastern ones are of a similar nature. I think China might be the only one that's not based on that, but that's because they've internalized all of the money that comes into China and they get to decide how it's distributed. Equal, same thing. But the point around that is not to say that you need to be an oil-rich country to have a sovereign wealth fund. It's to say that a sovereign wealth fund that is resource-backed, and when you have such strong resource deposits, whether it's oil, whether it's gold, whether it's diamonds, whether it's commodities, doesn't really matter what it is probably a very good starting point. Because I think about someone like Russia that's got more natural gas reserves than anyone in the world, than the whole of Europe. They can build it around that, right? You think about a country like South Africa. We've got gold deposits. We have platinum deposits. We're rich in commodities that we can use to do that. And that brings up, obviously, the conversation around nationalization. Should we nationalize the mines, et cetera, et cetera? And that's a separate conversation.
Yeah, because none of these folks nationalized mines. Right. That's okay. The Middle East, some of them, you just started off owning them.
But that's it. So we'll come back to nationalization and privatization of assets and all of that. That'll be a separate deep dive. But this one in particular, around sovereign wealth funds, clearly they can work. There is clear evidence that suggests that there's a good and a bad, and more good than bad, to having a sovereign wealth fund in place. I mean, the fact that our own former finance minister, Tito Mboweni, spoke to that as well, and the EFF has spoken to it, the president, Cyril Ramaphosa, right now has spoken to sovereign wealth funds as well as part of electioneering. It's worth looking into, right?
Yeah.
Why would a country want to have one? What are the benefits of these things?
So let's go back to, let me first go back to my history at school. 31 May 1910.
Okay.
Forming of the Union of South Africa. Imagine if we had decided that we were going to start a sovereign wealth fund because we had gold and diamonds, yes, and coal, and we later discovered manganese and all these other things, et cetera, iron ore and all the rest. And imagine if we had said every year when the budget came along, we're going to take some of the monies received from this, which was just tax, right? Mm-hmm. You didn't do anything special. Now, you could have charged a 2% royalty or something like that, but even just from the tax proceeds, and stuck it into an investment account, a la PRC, but not, because that's for public sector pensions, and kind of invested it. And we now had this thing. So the Norway one provides 20% of their budget every year. Imagine where South Africa would now be in 2024. Now, it would have got plundered 100 times along the way by the apartheid state and the ANC government and everyone in between, make no mistake. But imagine in a world where it wasn't. I think the difference, perhaps, because I think it is telling that 4 or 5 are oil. And maybe what's telling about it is that there was a worry twofold. One, that oil would deplete, although in Saudi Arabia's case, well, in the Middle East's case, less so. Two, perhaps, that it was volatile. And maybe three, that they could see one day the demise of oil. I'm not sure what was the genesis of the thinking. But as a South African government in 1910 to say, you know what, we have got the world's gold here. Mm. We have got the world's... I mean, if you ever play Civilization and you look at your resources, if you were to play Civilization on the world map and they gave you South Africa, you'd win every time because all you don't have is oil. Turns out we even have oil. And gas and Alice. I mean, it's just, where would we be sitting today with a sovereign wealth fund? The trick is, so then it's like, everyone's like, well, we should start one today. Sure, but with what money?
Do you know what? I don't even think it's with what money. Because when I was looking at sovereign wealth funds and I was looking at the risks to sovereign wealth funds, it was the risks that you mentioned around the plundering. Mm. The risks to sovereign wealth funds are government risks and corruption. Mm. Two things for the last 30 years we have excelled at, which is not a good thing to excel at. And so I think the biggest risk to a sovereign wealth fund in South Africa is that it will be misused.
Yeah.
It has not, to come back to what you're saying, Sai, around the ripple effect of having the sovereign wealth fund in place. You can protect an economy from structural shocks, from things like COVID. You can roll out stimulus packages. You can feed your people. You don't even need a social relief grant, because when you have that kind of a sovereign wealth fund, if administered and run properly, this can be a game changer. This can fundamentally end unemployment in South Africa.
Because you can start industries. We could start a space industry in the Free State where it's cheaper to launch rockets and we've got the helium and gas that they need to
already
get them into
there.
The sky.
Exactly.
Yeah. So the risk is, and it comes to your point, that it gets misused. So we don't start a space industry, or we do start a space industry and they put me in charge. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. So I just I just flip around
sign
in my
off
friends
on things.
Yeah, I just sign off and think. You know, or we do, sort of pet projects rather than properly thought through, etc. And maybe that is more than anything else. The sovereign wealth funds that have really worked because of really strong structures and things in place.
The discipline that comes with that.
Having $1.7 trillion.
It's not your petty cash. It's not your money that you get to disperse, right? Because I think that's the other part of sovereign wealth funds is they are government owned, but they are for the people of the country. So yes. I'm all for, and I've always been of the view that we need a sovereign wealth fund in South Africa. I still maintain that view.
Yeah.
But I'm also quite conscious of the fact that, and this might come from kind of the experience on asset management side of things, is to say, the asset management framework that exists in South Africa at the moment, if you look at FSCA regulation and the fiduciary duties and the obligations of an asset manager towards the shareholders, is the kind of rules-based structuring we need for a sovereign wealth fund, almost as if it must be administered and managed by a asset manager or a central bank or whatever, and not by a government. Because a government that is pushing policy very often does not, and this is not specific to South Africa, this is any real government. When you're pushing policy, you're very seldom thinking about the financial implications of said policy. You're saying, I want this policy to go through because it'll have this effect or whatever, whatever. But when you run a sovereign wealth fund, you need to replenish the fund. You need to grow the fund. You need the fund to disperse into projects that are sustainable and viable. And that is how you build an economy. Right? I'm not saying that the sovereign wealth fund is the only way to build an economy, but if we're talking about infrastructure development, investing in people, ending unemployment, those core things that are critical to rebuilding a country, you need to be able to separate, hey, this is the policy of this particular political party, because political parties at that point don't matter. Yeah. They shouldn't matter.
Yeah, that's actually a good
your
point.
Ideologies around, oh, we think that land and this and this and this and that. You guys, you can have those policies. I'm happy to have those policies. You can discuss and debate those policies and put them in place. But where it comes to fundamentally running a fund that is supposed to self-regenerate and self-replenish, self-sustain, and contribute in the form of withdrawals and drawdowns and all of that stuff to finance roads and all of that, you don't have the luxury of saying, but we want to tackle 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 other socialist policies as well. It needs the most amount of discipline.
Yeah, it absolutely does. It almost needs to be the equivalent of like a blind trust, right? And again, maybe, I know nothing about Norwegian politics, but the Middle Easterns are usually sheikhs and the like, and maybe it's that level of control. But it is, every time the government changes, does the new government come in and have new plans and new ideals and you know, I don't know, the prime minister, president, whatever you have in your country is like, you know, big on trains. So are we going to build a fast train or a smart city or whatever the case may be? And then suddenly it just becomes, you know, at the whim of, and it kind of goes nowhere. It needs to be fundamentally independent. I mean, almost in a sense, like what the PRC is. So our deputy finance minister chairs the but that's as far as it goes.
That's it. So we're,
and the Reserve Bank, who's nominated for 5 years, and you know the governor, and you need to have that independent structure. Now you can write that into the constitution.
That's it.
But it can go horribly wrong, and we've seen that certainly at the PRC.
And perhaps that's another element of it, that you bring in the constitution around it, is to say, in the same way we have the PIC stand on its own, you have the Reserve Bank stand on its own, you have the constitution stand on its own, perhaps a sovereign wealth fund should be constitutionally driven, not government driven. Because constitutionally driven means you are giving the constitution and the people of that country priority over any one particular economic policy at any one time. And interestingly enough, you bring up Norway, right? Norway now has abandoned charging stations for electric vehicles because their sovereign wealth fund and their structures and everything they're doing now affords them the ability to deploy capital into a wireless charging road. The entire road charges vehicles. You don't need a charging station. And that kind of infrastructure development you can achieve with a sovereign wealth fund. You can achieve with saying, government, happy. You guys do policy, you guys do economic what, and everything. Then you apply to the sovereign wealth fund to finance your projects. You don't get to decide how the capital's deployed or in.
You do a pitch.
You do a pitch, a formal pitch. Mm. There's a group of investors. You get the smartest minds in the country. You put them on almost the same way you've got a constitutional panel of judges where you take something to the Con Court. You put in the smartest business minds in the country that have an experience of both policy as well as financial management, because you need both, right? You need to be able to understand which projects might take priority over others, which investments might push the country forward. But you can't have it be defined by a presidential term. You can't have it be governed by over the next 5 years. This is, it needs to exist in perpetuity along a timeline that is not a political timeline.
Yeah.
Regardless of which president comes in, regardless of which political party comes in, It needs to exist.
And then there would be a mandate, much as our Reserve Bank has, much as the PRC has. And the mandate might be grow this thing, in which case if you come something that is good for society but not for profit, well, then it's turned down. But your mandate could also be keeping unemployment below 5% or whatever. You know, I mean, you can have multiple mandates.
So you have to manage both, right? So as the sovereign wealth fund, you have to then say, yes, we are for profit, but that profit needs to bleed into social infrastructure. So if we're just accumulating money, but we're not building roads, or unemployment is getting out of hand, or inflation is getting out of hand, or we're not protecting the people of the country that we are tasked with serving, then we are also not fulfilling that mandate. And perhaps that's why the mandate could be constitutionally driven.
Yeah,
maybe that's another way to look at it.
So it comes back to our Saab mandate, which is protect the value of the currency, promote financial stability.
That's it.
Yeah.
And they execute on that mandate with regardless of what is happening around them, right? Yeah. And I think that's such an important part of making a sovereign wealth fund work, is there are always going to be factors around you.
Oh, sure, sure. No, they're going to be populist
presidents. They're never going to go away.
I mean, Ramaphosa comes in and he wants to show great growth. So, well, hey, sovereign wealth fund. Yeah, Zuma was there and wanted to, I don't know, buy something. Well, hey, there's, let's not forget the apartheid rulers who would have, who knows what they would have squandered it on. There is risk to it. It's protectable. I like your point. You know, I said, why don't we go back to 31 May 1910? The answer is we can't. But what about, 31 May 2025?
I mean, that's it.
You know, and we can start small. I mean, I'm sure the first deposit into the Norway Sovereign Wealth Fund
wasn't a billion.
No, it was like, really?
That's your plan? That's it. But you need to, if you're starting small, and as you say, so if you're going to build this thing, you have to understand that it's almost like building generational wealth.
Yeah.
You're not building it for yourself. You cannot build it to service you, but you can build it so that South Africa as a country no longer has a 33 or 34% unemployment rate, it has an unemployment rate closer to 2%.
So here's a fun fact. So it was first in Norway. It was proposed in 1983, established in 1990, first capital transfer to the fund only in 96. This thing's not even 30 years old. It's younger than Tito Mboweni when he became a minister. And it used to be called the Government Petroleum Fund, because that's what it was. Mm-hmm. It is set up by an act of parliament, etc. But it's a new concept. Mm. And it goes back to best time to plant a tree, 20 years ago. You didn't? Well, then it's
today. Do it now, yes. Yeah. But that could be the other thing, right? So how do we build the sovereign wealth fund? Quite easily. You go in, and everybody's been talking about, we need to redistribute the wealth, we need to redress all of these things, blah, blah, blah. And that does need to happen. And that is, it might not be happening at the pace that we want it to happen at. It might not be happening in the way that we want it to happen at. But it's very easy for you to go to the companies in the JSE and say, guys, we're imposing a sovereign wealth tax, and we're writing this into the constitution. And companies that want to operate in South Africa, whether you want to operate a mine, whether you want to operate, so whether you're a Glencore operating here, an Anglo operating here, it doesn't really matter what company you are. Depending on the industries, or depending on your revenues, or depending on whatever variables, again, this is what governs the mandate, you have to contribute X percentage towards your sovereign wealth fund. If you choose not to, then sorry, you're going to lose your mining rights, you're going to lose your licensing rights, all of that stuff. And those things, I can guarantee you, a company is not going to be upset about contributing towards that, because they understand that they're operating in that country, especially a foreign company that isn't domestically based. And the domestically based companies will also contribute towards that, because yes, it might seem like a form of a tax that is uncomfortable and nobody wants the tax. But if you're taxing them at 2 to 3 to 5%, as long as you're administering and deploying that capital, that's the part that falls short. It's not the collection and the generation of the money or the gathering of that money. But if in year one, you raise from a corporate tax or a sovereign wealth tax of 5%, you raise 4 billion rand. In year two, that 4 billion should still be there, should be growing. Yeah. You get a new 5%. The point is, you're growing a fund. You're not going to say, we've got 4 billion, we're now going to go bail out something else. That must be the clear distinction. And perhaps that's why it needs to exist in its own state, in its own capacity.
Yeah, and it absolutely is. And it comes back to the point. You know, I remember once, doing my tax return and I'd paid X tax and the media was full of, and I think it was Blade and Zabundi getting a R3/4 million Mercedes. This was a long time ago, but you could still buy a fancy Mercedes. And I was like, yo, dude, my tax didn't even, yeah, my tax going to social grants and potholes, mm-hmm. I love buying ministers' cars, not so much. Mm. But tax in of itself is inherently not a bad thing. Right, because it builds your infrastructure, it builds you ports and hospitals and roads and schools and employs teachers and nurses and all of those sort of things. Mm. As long as it's properly used, tax is not bad.
And you're also not taxing the individuals in an economy that cannot afford to be taxed. You're not placing the burden and the pressure on the people that cannot afford it, but they're going to directly benefit from all of the things that you put in place.
No, 100%, and that's just it. It's not onerous. And you say 2, 3, 5. I mean, I think we could get away with 2%, small little tax. Nice and simple.
Doesn't affect anyone's life. Yeah. Well, we'll put together a proposal. We'll send it through. We'll write an open letter to the state. Maybe we'll get a sovereign wealth fund. That's the deep dive for this week, though. And we wrap things up with our investor insights. We're taking a look at the taxation implications on bonuses. We looked at crypto tax. We thought, why not look at taxes on bonuses? Because it kind of affects you whether you wanted to or not. As long as you're earning a bonus, there are certain tax implications, and you kind of want to look at how that could potentially be mitigated or what other measures you can put in place. And of course, we update our wall. Taxes on bonuses.
Yeah, so let's take an example. Is you're earning 20 a month and you get a 13th check. So you're getting 20,000 in December. And you're like, cool, I'm going to get 20,000.
No, you're not.
No, you're not. I mean, you're going to get taxed. There's also a risk. So and the reason I use 20,000, because effectively you're paying 18% tax on your salary because you're earning for the first 237,000. Mm-hmm. But then you step into a higher level. So your 20,000, you look and you see you're paying, that's what I pay in tax. Mm. But the bonus is actually then taxed at the higher level because it pushes you into the next higher rate and you then pay 26%. So suddenly your 20,000, you're expecting, I don't know, I'm making a number, 17, and you get 14 and a half, and you're like, whoa. Now there's tricks you can do to manage this. And suddenly you just get less than you think because SARS takes their cut.
But more often than not, on the tricks side of it, more often than not, you can't do anything about it because you don't have the discretion to decide when or how the bonus is paid to you, right? Mm-hmm. And I bring up the how because it's quite interesting. SARS looks at your income. That determines your tax bracket. And as you're saying this quite importantly around, it's throwing you into a different bracket. Depending on when that happens, you could be in serious trouble. So if you think about your typical financial year runs 1 March to 28 February. If your bonus hits in December and SARS then says, oh, right, effective this time, you are now classified at this bracket. It means all future salaries are in that bracket. So if you were at 18%, you're now at 26%. All of your normal salaries that previously would have come in at 18% are now, in SARS's eyes, at 26%. And SARS does this very deliberately because then they say, oh, if we've overtaxed you, we'll refund
send
you.
Send your money back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So pay now, question later. But think about someone that earns their bonus on the 1st of May. You've got an entire financial year that you're going to be taxed at a higher rate, and you must rejig your entire life for that year because suddenly you're in a different tax bracket. And that's kind of where people don't really, you know, understand. Like, why is this happening to me? Why am I paying so much? Yes, you'll get the money back later. But what we've often realized is I don't have time for later.
Yeah.
Right?
So the trick is you go to HR and you say to HR, my salary is 20 a month, 240 for the year. But actually, I've got a contractually agreed 20,000 Rand 13th check. Please tax me on a salary of 260 every month.
Okay, so you voluntarily say that ahead of time.
You actually pay a little bit of tax every month, a little bit extra tax on the 11 months you don't get the bonus. So when the bonus comes, it arrives at essentially the same amount, except it's more because there's no medical aid, there's no all the other bits and pieces.
I never knew you could do that.
You can do that. You absolutely can. And you speak to your HR. Now, the requirement is that your bonus needs to be, you know, some jobs are, you will get a 13th check.
Yes.
No question asked. 16 December, 13th.
But what about a variable bonus?
Doesn't work. That just doesn't work.
Because if I don't know what my bonus is going to be, I don't know how far. So if my bonus is going to be a fixed number, I can then work that fixed number into the rest of the stuff. But if my bonus is going to be a percentage of a bonus pool or a discretionary amount or whatever, then how do I plan for it in that case?
Yeah, that's more complicated. I mean, then in essence, what you could do is you could go in and try and become a provisional taxpayer. That's a whole heap of trouble.
Yeah.
Where at the beginning of the year, you say, cool, this is what I expect to earn. You essentially make two tax payments, one now, one mid, and then one a catch-up payment.
Yeah.
And you say, I'm expecting to get this, but now you've got to try and guesstimate what you think that bonus is going to
be. Which is difficult if the bonus is determined by the company and not by anything else.
And you do get two chances to do the guess, because you do a beginning and the mid, but it is still tricky in terms of doing it. So that works for a sort of regular salary paid. As soon as you're getting fluctuating bonuses and the like, I'm thinking of the bankers who you don't want your
performance bonus.
Yeah, there's going to be a bonus pool and folks are going to get money and no one knows how much.
And you don't know.
Even my little just one lap, do I pay bonuses? Sure. How much do I pay? To be perfectly honest.
Depending on the income.
It depends how much money's in the bank account on bonus day.
Yes.
So I can't tell you until a week before and I'm like, okay, maybe a month before. But it is – it's be prepared for it. It's that bonuses are great, but you're getting it – your manager says, you've done great. We're going to give you a 40K bonus. You're not going to get 40K landing in your account.
Is there a way to defer the bonuses or to defer – and say, so you'd earn your salary and you'd know what your salary is. And when the bonus comes, not a lot of people are in the fortunate position of senior executives where you can say, guys, I don't want my bonus in cash. I want my bonus in share options. Mm-hmm. I don't want my bonus in this. I want my bonus paid out in. Some people don't get to decide on the variable compensation. And then in that case, how do you get around it? I suppose this is where you sit down with a tax consultant or a tax specialist and you say, I might or might not get a bonus. How do I prepare for it? Because you also don't want to be just contributing towards additional tax. And then at the end of the year, the company says, oh, sorry, we didn't make profits this year. Therefore, nobody gets bonuses. And you've just gone and completely.
Well, you'll get that back from SARS. But
you would, but,
yes,
you,
but yeah, I hear you.
You want to avoid
you
that.
You don't want to have to wait.
Yeah.
So you need to speak to a tax person. And that's. No, not free, but it's not going to break the bank. You need to speak to HR and remember that not always on your side, but you can go and have these conversations with them and say to them, how can I be more efficient around the bonus coming? And they're going to say, what bonus? And you're going to say, well,
of course.
if it does. And at the end of the day, you might not be able to. I mean, if you're a salaried worker with a guaranteed bonus, we talked around that, that's quite easy to do. If your bonus is determined on your performance or company performance or the exchange rate or the weather or who knows how, because I don't know about you, I don't get bonuses.
No.
These are abstract concepts we're talking about.
Foreign concepts.
Hey, like me a bonus.
Although, if anyone in our community is happy to pay us a bonus, we would gladly accept the bonus. We're not going to say no.
And we will disclose it.
And we'll disclose it, yes.
Back to Mbaweni. He got some spices last month, so he discloses it on Twitter. And it's the tweet is, here I am disclosing the receipt of gift of spices.
There we go. You have to. And there's an accounting standard, fringe benefits. We'll disclose. No, we'll. I think it's I-17. Stand corrected. I'll
never know which one it is. but so the thing is that don't be passive about it. I suppose is what I'm trying to say. Don't be passive. Engage it. I know when I worked at Standard Bank, bonuses were announced February-ish, and then they were paid March and October. So if you left, you got half in March, half in October. And if you weren't there for October, you lost it. It's called golden handcuffs. But what they were essentially trying to do is keep you in. But what you now know is the next one is coming, right? Mm. And in Feb, you know what's happening. So engage, find out what it's going to be, if at all, how much. And at that point, don't just I'm going to get ripped on tax. It's like, start talking, start seeing what you can do about it. Start seeing how you can make it more efficient. And it's partly around the tax. It's partly around the surprise, the lump, the new brackets, getting less than you think. Taming back from SARS is all well and good, but not an efficient way to manage cash flow.
It's not. It really isn't. That international standard is employee benefits, IAS 19, not 17. My accounting teacher and lecturer would be very upset and very disappointed in me. But let's look at some stock picks. We've got some local picks, international picks.
Mm-hmm.
Let's dig into some local picks first, I suppose.
Sure.
We kick off with Calgro M3.
Yeah, so I mean, I hold the stock. Big disclaimer up front there. They build houses.
And memorial parks.
And they were so results were out. Unit sales were down. Revenue was down. But HEPS was up. And there's because of some accounting tricks there. Except not tricks. Just you're the accountant here. You know it's messy.
Remeasurements and reclassifications. But I mean, you know,
they have their cheapest unit is 636,000 for a 2-bedroom unit XVAT. I don't know why they told me XVAT. I know why they, but anyway, because no one pays XVAT. Mm-hmm. They're going to bring in a 1-bedroom for 350,000. They're going to bring a 2-bedroom in for under 500,000. South Africa desperately needs housing.
Affordable housing.
Mm-hmm. We have a chronic shortage, and they're just doing it well.
Something the Sovereign Wealth Fund could finance as well. But
there's,
we move on.
There's that as well. Yes, yes. And I just, Vikas Lotterhan is leaving. Jean-Pierre Moherbe, who was one of the original founders of Calgro, is coming back at the end of the year. I just think we're in a good space where, you know, consumers are going to be better off next year. I mean, a 0.25% rate cut doesn't change hardly anything. Mm-hmm. But with a little bit of two-pot money coming in, I mean, we know all the story around that. And I think Calgro is just really interesting. We had the Baldwin update as well 2 weeks ago. And
I remember we have Baldwin on a void on our wall. Stay away from Baldwin.
Yeah, and I'm looking at Baldwin and thinking, you know, maybe things are looking better for them at this point as well. Those results are going to be a horror when they come out. They haven't yet arrived, but they're going to be an absolute horror. But results are backward looking. Mm. And of the two, I think Calgro is the better, and certainly the chart is a whole lot better. Mm-hmm. It's just a nice little stock in a really good space. It had a near-death experience a few years ago. It's managed that. The beauty of Memorial Parks is the plan there, and I think they've hit it in these numbers. I chat with Vickers in the morning, is that pays their costs. Mm. So they don't have that, ooh, it's a tough year, we can't pay salaries.
No.
It's a tough year. People are still dying, so I've got the money coming from Memorial Parks.
Yeah. So that business clearly is doing a lot better than... And I suppose we will leave the other one that we had on the list where it is, and we'll add Calgro and see where we put that on our list. The other one was Sun International.
Yeah, so Sun International, SUI. Mm. So I hate their betting thing. I have moral objections to it, but no one listens to me. So, no, I mean, you should be allowed to bet. You shouldn't be allowed to advertise it, I suppose, is the thing. I mean, I don't know.
You're reminding me, you're taking me back to my childhood now.
Tobacco.
Michael Schumacher driving for Ferrari, Marlboro's banned by the FIA, which I don't know what the FIA was called back then, but Formula One, you could not advertise tobacco anymore. There was a huge uproar.
It was going to be the end of the sport.
It was the end of the sport. Oh no, this is horrendous. I remember that. And it was just like, you cannot, and that was the start of when we started to see health warnings on cigarette boxes. Prior to that, and I say this, and you're the smoker, you would know this better than I would. Prior to that, there was no health warnings on the boxes. No. Now suddenly we have to be health conscious and all of this stuff. And you're saying that this is the same with the betting stuff.
I think anything that's addictive should not be advertisable. And that includes alcohol, tobacco, gambling, and there's probably others as well. I think if it's an addictive product, you shouldn't be allowed to advertise it. But that's me.
Even with the disclaimer that says use responsibly.
There must be a disclaimer on the bottle and the cigarette pack and the gaming app and all of that sort of thing, et cetera. What really offends me, and I don't know about SunBet, which is Sun International, but I know two friends who got quite good at the sport betting on T20 and started making money, and then they get their accounts closed.
Okay.
Because they don't offlay the bet. They don't lay off the bet. It's like if you're a CFD trader, your broker doesn't phone you and say, you're good, you must go away, because your broker's not taking risk because they're hedging in the market.
Yes.
These folks apparently seemingly aren't hedging.
Well, that seems like that's more of a you problem as a business than
Well, no, not if you can then just tell your good people to go away.
Fair enough. Yeah. And you're going to keep taking money off the bad people. Yeah. That's the broker conversation.
Yeah, one entirely. I like the leisure stocks. I liked them a heck of a lot more on the day when Omicron was announced, which was going back to, was that late 21, something like that. I was supposed to be going to Paris in a couple of weeks, and well, that got cancelled. But I like the leisure. We've talked ad nauseum on this show and others around the improving consumer conditions for next year.
We've got City Lodge on our wall already.
Some of this is going to flow into leisure. Foreigners are we're always a good destination. Even when the rand strengthens, we are still a good destination
absolutely
for foreigners
because we're cheap.
It's because we're cheap. Gambling, there is one problem, is that there is the new Tobacco Control Act coming in at some point, which basically says smoking inside, no. You can't have a designated smoking act.
I remember
Now, if
that
you go look at markets, you've done it, and there's states in the US and Australia, your gambling revenue plummets about 15%. It then recovers, but it plummets by about 15%.
But it's a health thing. So here's the thing. I mean, if you go into, and I want to throw in a alternative to Sun International and say, how do we feel about Sun International versus Tsoho-san? Understanding, of course, that they operate kind of in the same leisure space, both with hotels and gambling facilities. But if you think about going into a closed environment or closed venue where you don't have a choice, for some people, it's a health concern. It really is. And for you to then prioritize the comfort of smokers...
Seems weird, right?
Because it's the same. I mean, I think about Tsoho-san. Their flagship offering, or the flagship venue, is Monte Casino in Four Ways. Monte Casino in Four Ways. You walk into Monte Casino. It's most of it is closed off. The entire casino area is closed off. They've got a separate smoking section and everything. But there's a section within the casino where you cannot. Now they've got all these rules and things in place, right? So you cannot sit at one of the tables, and you cannot be on your phone, or you cannot eat, or all of that. But you can smoke at some of the tables. So again, the logic there makes no sense. But to come back to the stocks, Sun International, Tsoho-san, do we like one more than the other?
Because
for me, Tsoho-san as well, having come up to this 12 to 14 Rand range, or even a 10 to 14 Rand range, you've been consolidating there for 2 years.
Yeah, I got to say, I might prefer Tsoho-san just because it's been consolidating, whereas Sun International
is about 40-something Rand a share.
44-ish, and could come back. The breakout is 42, 20-ish. It's 45 and some change. We could see some weakness coming through there. I might slightly actually prefer Tsoho-san. They're also slight nuances and differences. They're almost like a REIT in a sense in the space. I might prefer Soho.
Great. So we're going to put Sun International in our alternatives space because there is an alternative for it. International picks. I thought we could take a look at, and I don't want to do an analysis on all of them, but which is our preferred automotive company in Germany? They're all listed. Mercedes-Benz, BMW, Porsche, VW, all listed on the DAX, German Stock Exchange. Which of those, if we can only have one,
I was going to say race, which you've already done, but that's obviously not German. It is Italian.
Oh, no, but that could be an alternative now as well.
Ferrari.
No, we've got Ferrari on the list.
You kicked that door open to me twice. So there used to be a Porsche preference share. I'm not still sure if there still is. There's some structure. What's the structure with Porsche and VW? Is it that VW
is the parent company,
and
is separately listed,
and it trades at almost a discount to its holding in Porsche? There's some story there.
Okay. So VW at the moment is trading at about 92 euros.
What's its market cap?
Market cap on VW is about 52 billion.
And Porsche?
Porsche is at 69 euros with a market cap of 71 billion.
How come VW owns Porsche, but Porsche is worth more?
Porsche is worth more than all of them, firstly, and trades almost the cheapest of all of them. Mercedes-Benz is at 58 euros and market cap is at 60 billion. So Porsche is probably about 12 or so euros more expensive than Mercedes, but it has 10 billion euros more in market cap than Mercedes. Those are the top two. Then you've kind of got Volkswagen with a 52 billion market cap at 92. Then you've got BMW, 75 euro trading share price, 51 billion rand market cap. Lowest of the four in terms of market cap, but second highest in terms of share price. So VW share price is undoubtedly the most expensive of the four.
So it's actually a more complicated relationship. Porsche Automobile Holding owns 53% ordinary shares and 31.9% subscribed capital of Volkswagen. Volkswagen AG owns 100% of...
Volkswagen AG is the listed one.
of the Porsche AG entity responsible for.
That's the listed one.
Okay, this is all back to 2025. I remember there was a massive short squeeze. Mm. I like that. I'm interested in that triumphant. And if you're saying that Porsche is the lagger and the cheaper, then surely Porsche is the one.
Okay. Yes. It has got the highest market cap.
Yeah.
It is trading at probably 20 or so odd euros cheaper than the Volkswagen share. You have got less limited range, though. I must point that out. Because
yes.
Porsche, Volkswagen still also owns Lamborghini and other assets within there. Porsche on its own is just the Porsche brand.
And the Porsche is so cheap. I don't know if these numbers are right, but price to earnings is sub 3. Price to book is 0.2.
Well, it is. I'd rather buy a Porsche share than a Porsche because I could probably afford the share first.
Hey, look, I'd always rather buy a share than a car, but yes.
Okay. No, well, I think the experience of driving a German sports car might sway me in a particular direction. But for now, we're liking Porsche.
Yeah. So I'm ignore the numbers I mentioned a moment ago. This is something else entirely because it also told me sales was 50 million euros, which is basically one showroom's worth of Porsches. So I've got the wrong stock here. I am.
Okay, cool. The other one, Nokia.
Okay, now you're going to have to help me because I know Nokia started.
Are we looking at Nokia?
I think it started in whaling and then it did something else and then it made phones. And then there was that man who wrote the letter about we were on a burning platform and we have to jump off. And that was the last I heard.
So Nokia is listed.
Oh.
And where are they listed? Helsinki, Finland. So they're listed on the Helsinki exchange in Finland, which if I'm not mistaken, is one of the Euronext exchanges. We did this a couple of weeks ago. It is one of the Euronext exchanges.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
So the business at the moment, they're still a Finnish company. They're still headquartered in Finland. I don't really know what the business is.
Network infrastructure, mobile networks.
Yeah, they've kind of transitioned into telecommunications. Consumer electronics and all of that, we know them for that. But it looks as though they're more a telco kind of cloud solution-y environment. I can't think of anyone else that would... Well, I'm sure there's a ton of telcos that operate in the similar space to Nokia and that aren't Finnish.
And they're also not offering the actual Wi-Fi. They're offering network equipment. They will like fiber and routers, switches and stuff like that.
Disclaimer, this was a suggestion from one of our biggest community members, James Greenfingers Morris. We thank him for those suggestions as well. He wanted us to look at this to see if we had an interest in it, to see what our thoughts are around it. I am going to, first of all, express two things. One, I don't really have an opinion that I think I'd want to put this anywhere other than either neutral or avoid, for the simple reason that almost certain you're going to find better value out there.
So that's just it. I mean, I don't know about a neutral, but except there's better. So the valuation is not stretched. The chart looks fine. The consensus earnings is, or consensus forecast is, averages for whatever they have their kronas, whatever their currency is. The low is 290, the high is 650. There's 12 buys or sells, two strong sells. Sorry, 12 holds, some buys. It's not a horror stock.
Mm-hmm.
The chart looks interesting. I just can't, to your point, help thinking that if you were going into network equipment and stuff, is there not somebody better? And I don't know.
I'm almost certain there is. But also, my certainty could stem from a classic Simon Brown bias that says that markets have memories. And in my memory, Nokia has gotten it wrong before and they're likely to get it wrong
except
again.
Except they've been around since 1868, so they've done something right.
I'm sure they have.
But then, you know, your flip side is like a Cisco.
Or a Siemens back in Germany.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we were just looking at that. Siemens in Germany is the second largest company, but 160 billion euro market cap, trading at 185 euros a share. That already for me is a winner. yeah. compared to them.
Cisco, which is almost trading at its March 2000 levels.
Mm-hmm. March 2000, okay.
Cisco, I remember valuing Cisco and worked out that at the current assumptions the market was making, it would be more valuable than Earth by some decade into the future, also 10 years into the future. And well, it didn't, and it all collapsed. But to the point, you know, Cisco valuation a little bit higher, more liked, perhaps better known. To me, networking equipment, yeah.
Difficult, eh?
Yeah, I'm not sure where your competitive edge comes. Mm. Now, your competitive edge is you get an order from AT&T or the Norwegian government for X million of whatevers, mm-hmm. and you provide them and all is good. But then when they roll out, and then there's going to be a long tail maintenance on it mm-hmm. to some degree, but then you roll out your next 6G network, there's a new tender out there.
I'm going to say we avoid Nokia for now.
Yeah.
I can't seem to think of, and even if there is an alternative, I don't know if the alternative warrants making our list yet. We'll go out, we'll do some more digging around it. But for now, we're avoiding Nokia. And if there are thoughts and opinions around Nokia in our community, please put them up when we put up the video. Comment. Let us know what your thoughts are, because we want to get your thoughts. We want to get your ideas around, maybe we've got it wrong. Maybe you know something we don't know. There's a secret source. You found out that Nokia's going into ballistics missiles and they're going to make a lot of money from some other government contract that they're going to get. And we don't know, right? But that's the point of this community, to engage, to have these conversations, and to make sure that we continue to grow the community and continue to give you good results. Until next time. Investing isn't hard. Just try it.